This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Gadam Sulongkumar, the host of this channel. Today, I'm here with Dr. Douglas Duckworth to talk about his book, Tibetan Buddhist Philosophy of Mind and Nature. I think this is a very interesting philosophical work on Tibetan Buddhism, and I'm sure the listeners will have a very interesting and engaging time listening to Dr. Douglas. So let me straight away go to the author himself and ask about his background and how he came about writing this book. So Dr. Douglas, can you tell us something about your background? Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Lankumar, and thank you for having me. I teach Buddhism at Temple University in Philadelphia in the United States. And I was fortunate to go to India as an undergrad, where I was introduced to Buddhism and Bodh Gaya. And, I fell in love with the tradition and met wonderful teachers. And, after spending a few years, after I finished my bachelor's degree in Nepal and India, I went back to graduate school and the University of Virginia. And, I've been fortunate to spend time learning from, a lot of teachers in Nepal and India and Tibet and the United States. And, I've just been, fascinated with Buddhism and Tibetan or Himalayan Buddhism for, I guess, about a little over 30 years now.
Oh, yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. So this work, as you've told me, you have background in Buddhism and, going around the Himalayas and all. So obviously there is that the background to you of looking and studying and understanding, trying to understand Buddhism. But particularly coming to this book, how did this book come about, the idea for this? And, how did this, the idea for this book started? Yeah.
Right. When I was an undergrad, when I first became interested in Buddhism, it was through a philosophy class. And I'd always been interested in philosophy broadly. And when I learned about Buddhism, I just dove in, was very interested in learning more. And, 30 years ago, there wasn't as many books available in translation, but now you know, there's a lot of things, you know, good translations available. I think our understanding is getting better. Tibetan and Buddhism in the Tibetan language is really rich. And, you know, I thought the time was right to try to give some type of broad overview of Buddhist thought and practice, because a lot of the studies that I'd seen were, you know, on particular historical figures, you know, particular texts, particular traditions, and that's great. But I thought it would be helpful to try to synthesize these traditions and think about, you know, what issues are at stake, particularly for a broader audience that is coming from, you know, a philosophical perspective, but also for people who are Buddhist practitioners, as well as others who are based in a particular tradition and want to see how that particular tradition is contextualized within both the broader Buddhist world and also the broader kind of intellectual conversations around you know, Buddhist theory, Buddhist practice, how these relate. So I thought, you know, since I had tenure at my university and I was on sabbatical leave, and I'm on sabbatical now again, so it's been 7 years. I thought, you know, why not write this book? It's a book that's kind of overambitious. It's really broad in scope, but I felt that it was necessary, that it filled a gap in just providing a accessible introduction, but also an introduction that was not, you know, solely on the surface, but really got into some of the kind of deep issues and difficult points in Buddhist traditions as they are practiced in the Himalayas and in Tibet in particular.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because I think as I also came to this book, I mean, someone who is actually beginning to look into Buddhism, who is from anthropology background, I also have a background in philosophy. I mean, we know Buddhism from a general point of view, but then looking at certain particular branches of Buddhism, and specifically the Tibetan Buddhism, because there are so many branches, texts, teachings that are there, and to actually kind of have a grasp, have an idea of what kind of discussion and the branches that are there, the discussion that are going on, I think for me personally, I think it has been a really robust work in that sense. So the way you have described it, I think it really kind of caters to the way you have thought about it and the way you kind of envision the book, this book to be. So that's quite really interesting, yeah.
Right. What helped me?
Yeah.
What helped me was
carry on.
My dissertation, and which became a book called Mipham on Buddha Nature. So Mipham was like a late 19th and early 20th century figure. So he was quite late in the, you know, 1,000-year trajectory of Buddhism in Tibet, and he really synthesized a lot of these traditions. And I translated another text by one of his students, actually his student's student, Pubatulkul or Putrul, called Distinguishing the Views and Philosophies. And in that text, he just shows a range of positions on different topics. I was really surprised. I was like, wow, this, you know, all of this is called Buddhism, all of this is called Tibetan Buddhism, but there's so much diversity. These traditions are so different that it was fascinating to me. And he was at Nyingma, and he was showing the different, you know, assertions on different philosophical points by these different traditions, like the Kagyu and Jonang and Sakya and Gelug in particular. So that really was kind of the background that kind of enabled me through kind of working through those texts and his teacher's teacher, Mipham, in particular, that set me up to try to tackle this book that looked, you know, beyond sectarian traditions, but what looked at kind of a variety of approaches, but trying to kind of look at the core issues that are enlivening these debates, and try to put it in conversation with as you said, you know, philosophy more broadly on a global scale.
Yeah, that's quite Interesting. Yeah, so moving into the contents of the book, you mostly talk about the my language in the world and the interconnectedness to this. And in the introduction, obviously, you introduce from which perspective you're looking at it from and the people that you're looking at it from, and specifically the Madhyamaka, you know, Yogacara, and you're looking at also Nagarjuna, the aspect of emptiness, the ultimate truth, the middle way, and all of those aspects. So can you give a short introduction to what actually all of this concepts and what actually are you kind of specifically delving into? Yeah.
Right. So I struggled with, you know, how I would voice the book. And initially, like I was thinking about constructivism and realism. Like these are the two themes that I wanted to show that are interrelated. And as you said, you know, Madhyamaka and Yogacara, those are the two main Mahayana philosophical traditions from India. And, you know, but Madhyamaka, there's many different ways that that gets interpreted, the middle way, and also Yogacara, there's many ways it gets interpreted. And so I really struggled with how to do this. And I, also constructivism, that could also be a Madhyamaka tradition. It could also be a Yogacara tradition. So it didn't really fit pair well. But the Tibetans, they talk about the two chariot traditions, the Shingdan Ni. And these are two, like mind only and Madhyamaka. And I decided that, you know, that contrast would be good, although mind only tends to get a bad reputation in Tibet is kind of like as an inferior philosophical tradition to Madhyamaka. But at the same time, that's the language, that's the indigenous language that was used in Tibet. And but I didn't want to just stick with the indigenous language alone because, you know, I have to translate too. And so I thought about the terminology of phenomenology and ontology as, you know, roughly corresponding to the kinds or the styles of analysis that are done by, you know, Madhyamaka. This is primarily about ontology and deconstructing essences, deconstructing being or what is, you know, primarily oriented towards objects, and mind only or Yogacara being more attuned to phenomenology and looking at phenomena, appearances, the mode of what shows up in a lived world, and primarily taking the starting point of subjects. So again, phenomenology is also a disputed term in English and, you know, Western European traditions as well. And so I think I struggled with, well, should I use phenomenology? Am I kind of making things more muddled? But then I realized that, you know, these terms are contested. And they're contested just like mind only and Madhyamaka are contested in the Buddhist world. And so it actually makes sense to try to put these in conversation and not really try to map, you know, one of them on the other, but just talk about these family resemblances between these and how some of the synergy between these two modes of analysis, and how they're complementary and even mutually entailing kind of animated my decision to, you know, use these terms. So that is what I set up in the introduction, trying to think about method and how I can, you know, how I can structure this conversation in broad strokes, but also to be kind of honest to the particular traditions, and in particular the Tibetan traditions that I'm, you know, primarily focused on.
Yeah. I actually, yeah, that's quite interesting. So moving on, you actually talk about in the preceding chapter, you talk about the aspect of mind only, and then kind of delve into the aspect of, okay, you know, the object and the subject, and, you know, trying to understand this aspect. So can you give us an overview of what actually this discussion is all about? And, you know, in the subject of phenomenology and ontology, you know, whether this feed and this understanding of the nature of the reality, the world, and the being, how does this understanding fit in this perspective? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's a big question. And you had mentioned this kind of mind language world. And, you know, rather than like a mental subject or like a mental substance and an extended substance, like a kind of the mind-body dualism that is the legacy of Descartes, I find that in India and in Buddhism in particular, it's more of a tripartite, you know, three-part structure where you have the mind, you have the language, and then world or body, speech, and mind, you know, another way that this gets articulated. So I tried to structure the book around each of these topics, you know, a chapter on each, you know, so the mind in one chapter where I talk about, you know, the mind is can be an object that is deconstructed, or that or it could be like an illusory appearance. It can be, you know, undefined and undefinable, kind of a mysterious essence. But it can also be a subject that is, you know, that the mode by which the world arises and in terms of a phenomenological reduction, you know, that is, everything we know is something known. So we can't really separate this kind of subject, you know, abstract subjects out of a proper analysis, or at least a phenomenological analysis. And then with the language, what it means to be a thing, or what it means to be a being, is, you know, I believe it was Quine that said it was the content of a variable. So it is X. So we call it something, we define it, we delimit it within a certain kind of linguistic or conceptual boundary. And India is very rich, has a very rich philosophy of language, you know, Sanskrit, and the medium of basic of philosophy is language, just the way that the medium of science, you know, the language of science is mathematics. Language also is the constructive role of language is very, you know, rich and interesting, and the philosophy of language as it is developed in India, I think, is only matched like in the 20th century with like Wittgenstein and Heidegger, who were like the forefathers of kind of these two broad analytic and continental traditions. But we find, and I tried to make some, you know, connections to some of the disputes in India and Tibet with, you know, both the early and later, you know, Wittgenstein and Heidegger's. So anyway, speech and then body or world. So body, speech, mind, mind, language, world. So the last chapter, when I look at world or body, I try to theorize Tantra a bit, and I draw upon Merleau-Ponty's notion of flesh, like the where, you know, like the, use the example of a hand. You know, the hand is both the touching another hand. It's both a subject and an object. So the hand touching itself, or a hand touching another hand, you know, this notion of like we are the flesh on the flesh of the world, or the eyes of the world, and this kind of collapse of subject and object that gets enacted or performed in Buddhist practices. So it's not just theory, it's not just abstraction or kind of disembodied thought, but it's also enacted in rituals and communities, in kind of lived experiences of contemplative practice. So, so I think that, you know, that's the guiding structure of the book, or those three, you know, body, speech, and mind, to use Buddhist kind of indigenous language, or mind, language, and world, which is, the language of how these are all interconnected and not really distinguishable, actually, only virtually distinguishable.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yes, I think that is quite interesting. So let's just dissect these concepts one by one. And I specifically want to go to the portion where you actually discuss about the aspect of self-awareness or awareness. And this is where you actually talk about this concept known as the objective idealism. And so this is where you also argue that there is this internal relation between the perceiver and the perceived. So in terms of this self-awareness, specifically coming to this, can you expound more on this idea that you talk about? Yeah.
Yeah, so that term self-awareness, has a lot of different meanings, or swasamvedana, swasamvitti in Sanskrit. It obviously doesn't mean an awareness of self, right? Because the Buddhists are, anatmavada, right? They don't claim a self. I make a distinction between different types of self-awareness, but an important distinction is between reflective awareness and reflexive awareness. So reflective awareness is like introspection, like thinking about the self. Whereas reflexive awareness is like it's built into the structure of awareness that it's kind of self-presenting as it presents an object. And people often use the term idealism, as a way to describe Yogacara or even mind only, that term that Tibetans will use, simsam, mind only. When people talk about it in English, or often, idealism is thrown around, without much reflection about what that means. What does idealism mean? And I try to make it a distinction between kind of subjective idealism, which is basically, like Bishop Berkeley, right? That everything, there is no external world. It's all just collapsed into the internal mind. Unlike Berkeley, the Buddhists don't have this God, so I'm not going to Berkeley described. But anyway, the subjective idealism, but I wanted to contrast that with an objective idealism that is, all relations are internal relations. So there is really nothing outside in the world. The world is, I guess, bipolar, you could say. Like there's a subjective aspect and an objective aspect, and these are relational, but we can't really talk about anything outside our lived experience of the world. That becomes metaphysical, that becomes beyond the observable universe, so to speak. It's not meaningful in a an empirical sense, in a Buddhist sense, to talk about something that we can't experience. It just becomes like a metaphysical claim that is, just a dogma. So this term objective idealism, I drew from Charles Peirce, and you mentioned this internal relation. Hilary Putnam uses this kind of internal realism, that there is no, nothing outside this structure, objective realism. But there is still causal regularity within the system. So the relation between a subject and object, or between mind and the world, is not random either. It's not all mental projection, nor is it kind of coming from the outer world and impinging upon the inner world, but it's just this relational structure. And so I think Yogacara is trying to articulate this structure. And so on one hand, it's this type of system building, kind of coming up with this system that's a very sophisticated system of philosophy. And on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you get like the Padyamaka tradition, in particular the Prasangika Padyamaka, that's this kind of radical deconstruction that wants to throw suspicion on any type of system building projects and rejects this notion of kind of a coherent system and exposes contradictions or prasangas, right? Or this reductio ad absurdum in any kind of attempt to get to capture a whole system. So, you know, in each chapter, when I do talk about, you know, self-awareness or reflexive awareness, I try to show how, you know, both Yogacara and Vidyamaka, you know, have, you know, different ways that this is interpreted. And there's this type of push and pull between these tendencies of affirmation and negation that we see that kind of keeps the kind of the energy of Buddhist philosophy kind of alive, you know, in between the kind of positive and negative poles, like of a battery. You get this, you know, this affirmation, and, you know, we need the mind, we need self-awareness to build a coherent epistemology, but yet wait, you know, what does that mean to be self-aware? Does that mean that there is knowledge? Does it have an object? Is it does it count as knowledge if it's not if it doesn't have an object? So there's all these this pushback of against reflexive awareness by the Vidyamakas and Prasangika Vidyamakas in particular, and yet the centrality of this as the basis of the world, as the basis of liberation for, you know, traditions of yogic practice and contemplative practice in Tibet. So yeah, these issues are complicated and they're multivalent. You know, there's many different perspectives on them. I touch upon it in that, I believe it's the third chapter a bit, but there's, I just kind of, I feel like in this chapter, I just plant the seeds of thought for people, or just kind of point the way to, you know, now you can go and look at these other texts and think about these issues with some context, you know, dig further and deeper into this this issue that I just introduced a bit.
Yeah, true. I think the internal cohesiveness of the you know, subject-object relation, and, you know, the way it has been conceptualized by different traditions is something really interesting. And I think you do a very good job at trying to kind of bring out that kind of discussion that is there. So that is really very interesting. So moving on to language here, and also, you know, one of the things that I have since. In terms of Buddhism, I have looked at people, I mean, who have practiced it, but I think moving to Bhutan, it has been really interesting as to how, you know, living with them very closely to see how these rituals are performed for them, the chantings that are there, the, you know, voices of instruments that are there, and voice becomes a very important denominator of for them to actually perform these rituals, and also the elements of the nature that is there. So this is where, when we come to the language that is there, I think there are different understanding of this concept, and also this aspect of perceive that is there, you know, the perception, the inception aspect of this. And this is where you also kind of talk about this aspect of conceptualizing and perception in the Buddhist tradition, and also where you talk about how these two kind of dichotomy collapses in the tradition. So can you delve more and kind of help us understand this aspect? Yeah.
Right. So Buddhists have a peculiar relation with language, you know. So on the one hand, like, language kind of obscures it, you know, it abstracts and it obscures the actual thing. Like, you can talk about the taste of honey all day long, but until you put it on your tongue, you're not going to get the experience of that taste of honey. But yet, language is also important, you know, to communicate ideas, to point and draw lines around the world in different ways, kind of open up new vistas through framing the world differently. So on the one hand, language kind of obscures. On the other hand, it discloses. Language is important because I think ultimately that the performative aspect is something I've really tried to emphasize across this book. Certainly, for instance, language of emptiness. On one hand, for certain traditions, like we see for Tsongkhapa and the Gelug tradition, your language is important to identify the object of negation. Like, what is it that is to be negated? What is it that a Buddhist is supposed to do? And what is it that a Buddhist is supposed to understand? And it's important to articulate this. It's important to articulate that there is no intrinsic essence in anything, and to make that claim, make that assertion, understand it. I mean, obviously not just as a proposition. It should be contemplated and internalized, but that's an important element. And it's a means to internalize through expressing, through conceptualizing. These serve important functions. But at the same time, language is not simply about propositions, but it's also, Austin's, speech acts. We have like illocutionary denials and locutionary denials. We have, language that, is performative, like speech acts, like saying I do in a marriage ceremony. It's more than just stating a proposition, it's a commitment. And particularly this is interesting, I found in articulations of emptiness in the, particularly the Prasangika Padyamaka school, where there are no claims made in certain traditions, and it's only a negation, it's only a performance of an enactment of negation. And this extends not just to kind of on the debate courtyard or in a dialectical context, but also, as you said, in these rituals, these ritually enacted performances of this, the subject object, the unity of, appearance and emptiness and form and emptiness and such. So this collapse of that we see, which is a theme in the book, like you mentioned, between percept and concept, between subject object, between even language as object and language as subject, right? So language is both a sound and it carries meaning. So it evokes a thought in the mind, but it's also there's like sound waves. It's a physical thing as well, but also theory and practice. And so this boundary between theory and practice, how we theorize is a practice. And our practices are, more than often are implicit, but there's an implicit theory about the world, practices, are theorized in different ways, sometimes explicitly, but more than often implicitly. And thinking about language, I found is a, there's a lot of resources in Buddhist thought in general and Indian traditions broadly that really look deeply at the nature of language and how language kind of mediates between the mind and the physical world. And I think this this chapter, I guess it's chapter 4 where I discuss language, I talk a little bit about these the background in different theories about language. And how they influence an ontology in a way that can be seen to kind of correspond. A certain metaphysical views have corresponding philosophies of language, and I think that's another kind of seed in this chapter that I feel like that could be expanded a lot. There's a lot of implications that could be drawn out, but with the boundaries of the topic of the book. And I I was already biting off more than I could chew and more than I probably should try to chew. But there's certainly more to be said and to think about in terms of the importance of language and kind of Indian philosophical traditions.
Yeah, very interesting. So coming to the last one, to the aspect of body, and I mean, many of the philosophical concepts and the ideas and the notions that we have is that, you know, the person, the individual is encapsulated in the body, and that there is this dichotomy and distinction of where one's percept of the outer world kind of ends. And this is where the aspect of the other minds also comes into the picture, where yourself and the other self is a distinct self in that sense. And this is where the discussion of body in that sense also comes into the affective nature of the body in that sense, and that there, this dichotomy also comes into the very aspect of how the individual kind of relates to the outer world in the and the environment. But also at the same time, as we have been discussing, this kind of ideas kind of collapse when we look at certain Buddhist traditions that we are talking about. So can you explain and expound more on this aspect of a body and its relation to the participatory and the enacted aspect of the body, and how it relates to the kind of traditions that we are actually discussing about? Yeah.
Right. So, you know, once again, you know, I've said this before about the other chapters, but in this chapter in particular, chapter 5, in some ways, it's the culmination of the book. And in the on the other hand, it's also in some ways the least developed, because again, I feel like there's so much more that it was a starting point. But I was, you know, trying to theorize philosophical tantra. So tantra is such a complex kind of subject matter. And often, and for some traditions, even in Tibet, like Tsongkhapa, for instance, says it's a ritual distinction. You know, it's a distinction in method, but not in view. It's not really a philosophical distinction. But other traditions, particularly in the Nyingma tradition, which I was, you know, more familiar with, there's a very important philosophical distinction with tantra. So the way that the body is theorized, the way that speech and mind, how these three elements are interrelated, how there may be, you know, aspects of a world. And, you know, how different worlds get enacted when, you know, the body is manipulated, when speech is modulated in different ways. So I was trying to draw some preliminary connections about how we might think about the body. And particularly, again, I drew here on Merleau-Ponty a little bit. And again, his visible and invisible, his late work, which was unfinished, where he articulates this notion of flesh that doesn't really get really clarified, because it's this unfinished work. And he was drawing from Heidegger, who didn't really articulate the body, but, you know, I think inspired a lot of, you know, phenomenologists to think about embodiment. And particularly environmental philosophy, I think ecological thinking, you know, deep ecology, we get this, you know, interrelation of body, kind of this extended body, the extended, you know, where the boundaries of the body don't kind of, like, as you said, you know, end with the skin. You know, we're constantly, you know, breathing in and out and eating and excreting and kind of involved in relationships with the human, you know, human and more than human world. So I tried to connect some of those registers of thought with kind of tantric rituals, which tend to highlight the processes of like birth, right, gestation, the processes of death and kind of stages of dissolution, and as well as the processes of sex, which is, people tend to focus on that aspect of Tantra. But Tantra is actually much more kind of rich and complex and multifaceted. And I try to draw out in some ways of thinking about the body and world in Tantra. And in particular, I look at in more detail at the contemplative traditions of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, or the Great Perfection, that are the practices that I see as developing from or extending from or enacting the philosophies of Madhyamaka and Yogacara. So these two traditions and the interplay between these two traditions is not simply theory, but is enacted, both in different tantric rituals and tantric traditions, as well as these distinctive kind of tantric modalities of contemplative practice that I find, personally very interesting and transformative. So this chapter, again, in some ways it culminates the book, because it explicitly shows this interrelation between not just subject-object, but this mind, language, and world, and how this might look like in a philosophical lived experience in these traditions. So again, it was kind of preliminary. I'm hoping people will take the threads that I put out there and in these seeds, and plant these seeds or weave these threads into kind of a more more filled out picture. But I found that that this was something that was it's a very rich tradition, but it hasn't really been articulated philosophically. It really hasn't been done justice in the English language, and so I was hoping to play a small part in doing some justice to this really rich and, as you said, these living traditions. So it's not just theory, it's not just kind of on the bookshelves or on the armchair, but part of the lived worlds and societies and ritual traditions and communities that across the Himalayan region.
Yes. Yeah. Quite interesting. Yeah. So we have come to the end of the discussion, and I wanted to ask, is there any interesting project that you are currently involved in now?
Yeah. So one of the inspirations for this book was what the late Gene Smith called the Gaimong movement. And the Gaimong movement is associated with people like Shapkar, Sotuk Drongdrol, and Pacho Rinpoche, and in particular this Nyingma and Gelug kind of hybrid traditions. Because Gene Smith coined the term the remade movement, right? The non-sectarian movement. And but when we look at these traditions, it's not like a big melting pot where everyone is just doing the same thing, or some type of perennial philosophy where it's a singular tradition, but there's actually a lot of diversity. And part of that diversity is between, Gelug traditions on one hand and non-Gelug, particularly Sakya and Nyingma traditions on the other. But what's interesting about the Gaimong movement, and Pacho Rinpoche and his students in particular, and his students include Mipham Rinpoche, who I mentioned I'd worked on, but another figure, Gunsan Sonam, who I'll say more about in a second, because that's my current project. They were very involved in engaging with the Gelug tradition, drawing upon the rigorous philosophical traditions and monastic traditions that they developed, and spearheading like these shedras, like the first monastic college in the and the eastern Tibet in Kham was at Dzogchen Monastery and Nyingma Monastery in the middle of the 19th century. And it really drew upon the success of the Gelug model of having these big monasteries and having a systematized curriculum. But it did so with an ethos or a vision of kind of yogic practice and these traditions starting in Dzogchen really spread out, Pelphong and Sonsar and other monastic colleges around and in Bhutan as well. But what's interesting about the Gelug movement is rather than a tradition that's very based on a sectarian identity, they were very much engaged, particularly across the Gelug and Nyingma. And so, in any case, one of Padre Rinpoche's students was Gunsan Sonam, and he wrote this massive commentary on Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. And Padre Rinpoche taught this text across different monasteries in eastern Tibet, and he did so in Gelug monasteries like Sershul Monastery and Kagyu and Sakya and Nyingma and Jonang, and he used different commentators from each tradition when he would teach. And in any case, one of his students, he had many students, but basically from his lecture notes, wrote this massive, it's like a thousand pages all put together. And so I've been working on this, since my last sabbatical, and I did publish, his ninth chapter. He broke it up into actually three separate commentaries, but he wrote a separate one on the ninth chapter, which I published as The Profound Reality of Interdependence, which really takes a Gelug, Tsongkhapa influenced interpretation of the ninth chapter, which is all about Madhyamaka. But the first eight chapters is really more kind of foundational to Buddhist practice and looking at ethics, looking at meditation and bodhicitta in particular. That's the main theme, the mind of awakening, and connecting that with emptiness and so compassion and emptiness being kind of two aspects of the mind of awakening. So in any case, I've been working on this translation, and it's supposed to come out in a year and a half. It's at the publishers now, but it's really been great because he really, in my mind, brings together the great perfection or Dzogchen and kind of mind training of which is an important tradition in cultivating kind of bodhicitta from the ground up, so to speak, and really embraces kind of a broad vision of Buddhist practice. And in this text, Shantideva in particular was, a master of poetry, a master of philosophy, and a master of kind of articulating a comprehensive vision of Mahayana Buddhism. And so this text is both a short kind of wisdom literature in aphorisms and short statements that condense in this and essentialize the essence of Buddhist practice, but they're also embedded in this kind of textual universe that Gunsan Sonam cites texts from across, the canon, hundreds of sutras, hundreds of shastras, and really ties them together in a very beautiful way. So I'm excited about this text, and I'm excited about, being able to engage with this tradition because it's very rich, and I've learned a lot, and I'm very fortunate to be able to spend my time, reading these texts and translating these texts. So, I hope, I hope someone reads it. I'm glad to hear that you read this, Buddhist Philosophy of Mind and Nature. But it's always nice to have conversations about, about these texts.
True. Yeah, really interesting project and works going on. Really, I'm also really excited about it, actually. So if anyone wants to reach out to you regarding this current discussion that we are having, if anyone wants to discuss further with you on the books and on your work, which is the best way to reach out to you? Yeah.
Probably email. You could probably just Google me and find my email. I work at Temple University, so my email is just my last name, duckworth@temple.edu. So that's probably the best way to get to me.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah, so I encourage the listeners, if anyone is like me and if anyone is from philosophy background and wants to look at the different traditions that are there and try to understand some of the aspects, the philosophical discussions that are there in different traditions, specifically coming to the Tibetan Buddhism, then I think you all need to get a hold of this very work. So thank you very much, Dr. Douglas Duckworth, for having this conversation with me at New Books Network. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Tia. It's been a pleasure.